Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the supposedly private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. I ended up the last show on discussing the Cold War. In arrangements which were so lucrative for Anglo-American business interests, why did the United States target Soviet Russia as the enemy in the Cold War following World War II? We had discussed how, in fact, in the years immediately following the October Revolution, there was a steady stream of large and lucrative, that is really non-competitive, contracts issued by the Soviets to the British and American businesses. And of course, that October Revolution we're talking about is in the Soviet Union. U.S., British, and German wolves soon found a bonanza of profit selling to the new Soviet regime. So why was there the Cold War? Well, it turned out that the plans of the international bankers, which created the whole business profit non-competitive setup, evidently went awry after Lenin died in 1924. Trotsky was in line to become the new leader, but Stalin succeeded in grabbing the reins of power instead. For the Trotskyites, Stalinist communism then became the enemy. Trotsky was expelled from Soviet Russia in 1928 and returned for a time to New York, meeting his death in Mexico in 1940 at the hands of a Soviet agent. The neocons, the new conservatives, the group most associated with the Cold War, have been traced to the Trotskyites of the 1930s. Through most of the rest of the 20th century, neocons fought to reestablish dominance in Russia. Srdjan Trikovic is a journalist who calls himself a paleoconservative, which is the old right as opposed to the new right. He writes that neocons moved from the paranoid left to the paranoid right after emerging from the anti-Stalinist far left in the 1930s and early 1940s. They had discovered that capitalism suited their aims better than socialism, but they remained consistent in those aims, which were to prevail over the Russian regime and dominate the world economically and militarily. They succeeded on the Russian front when the Soviet economy finally collapsed in 1989. The Central Bank of the Russian Federation was added to the League of Central Banks operating independently of federal and local governments in 1991. The economic destruction of Russia and its satellites followed. Jude Winiski, the Reagan-era insider, said that shock therapy was imposed on the Soviet countries after 1989 as an intentional continuation of the Cold War by other means. In February of 2005, in an interview shortly before he died, Winiski acknowledged that he was at one time a neocon himself, but he said that he had had to break with neocon policies after the Iron Curtain came down. He revealed, quote, "We were all cold warriors, united in a very hard line against communism in Moscow and in Beijing. We fought the Cold War together, and we were proud of being successful in the Cold War without having a nuclear exchange. But when the Cold War ended, the Russians invited me to Moscow to try and help them turn their communist system into a market economy, and I was glad to do that for free, but I had to break with my old friends because they said we didn't beat these guys enough. We have to smash them into the ground. We want to feed them bad economic advice, shock therapy, so that they will fall apart." End of the quote. Now, shock therapy consisted of austerity measures imposed in return for financial assistance from the International Monetary Fund and its sister agency, the World Bank. Nothing new here, folks. Also called structural readjustment, these belt-tightening measures included eliminating food program subsidies, reducing wages, increasing corporate profits, and privatizing public industry, all dictated by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. According to Canadian writer Wayne Elwood, structural adjustment is a code word for economic globalization and privatization, a formula which aims both to shrink the role of the state and soften the market for private investors. Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, testified in 1998 that Russia's steep decline after 1989 was a direct result of the harsh policies of the IMF, which were used as tools for subordinating the domestic economies of emerging market countries to the whims of the international financial markets. He told Congress, quote, "The IMF has presided over one of the worst economic declines in modern history. Russian output has declined by more than 40% since 1992, a catastrophe worse than our own Great Depression. Millions of workers are denied wages owed to them, a total of more than $12 billion. These are the results of shock therapy, a program introduced by the International Monetary Fund in 1992. Further, there was an immediate decontrol of prices. Inflation soared 520% in the first 3 months. Millions of people saw their savings and pensions reduced to crumbs." End quote. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we have this great plot by the IMF. However, on the other side, the IMF blamed the Russian hyperinflation on deficit spending by the government, but Weisbrot said it wasn't true. The real culprit was the IMF's insistence on tight money. Well, what does that mean? So he gave a quote. For the first 4 years of shock therapy, the government mostly stayed within the fund's target range. But as the economic collapse continued, tax collection became increasingly difficult. In addition, the necessary capital was not made available for the potentially efficient firms to modernize. Foreign direct investment was supposed to play a key role in providing capital, but this never materialized given the instability of the economy. During the first 2 years of shock therapy, the outflow of capital exceeded inflow by 2 to 4 times. The whole idea that Russian industry had to be destroyed so that they could start from scratch on the basis of foreign investment was wrong from the beginning. End quote. Instead of providing capital to promote productivity, Weisbrot said, the IMF squandered $5 billion on trying to support the plunging ruble in a futile attempt to maintain the exchange rate at 6 rubles to the dollar. The result was to deliver $5 billion into the hands of speculators while setting off panic buying and a new round of inflation. What was the point of trying to maintain the convertibility of the domestic currency into dollars? The IMF argues that it is essential to creating a climate in which foreign direct investment can be attracted, Weisbrot said. But that is clearly not worth the price in Russia, where the capital flows that were attracted were overwhelmingly speculative. This is another example of the IMF's skewed priorities, which have now brought Russia to a state of economic and political chaos. And again, that's a quote from Weisbrot. Russia had succumbed to the same sort of free trade policy that allowed British financial interests to invade America in the 19th century. It had opened itself to dependence on money created by outsiders, money it could have created itself, indeed had been creating itself, before the wolf got in the door in the form of the IMF shock therapy. The Soviet economic scheme had failed, but it was not because of its banking system. Economists blame the Marxist theory that prices and employment must be determined by the state rather than left to market forces. The result was to stifle individual initiative and eliminate the mechanisms for setting prices and allocating resources provided by the free market. This was very different from the American system prescribed by Henry Carey and the American nationalists, who encouraged free markets and individual initiative under a collective infrastructure that helped people rise together. The seeds of the American system just had not had a chance to grow properly in Russia. In other fields abroad, they would take better root, and we'll look at that next. So we'll look at sneering at doom. A bankrupt Germany finances a recovery without money, which is an important principle concept that we're trying to understand here. So back to the Wizard of Oz from the film. It says, frightened? You are talking to a man who has laughed in the face of death, sneered at doom, and chuckled at catastrophe. I was petrified. Then suddenly the wind changed, and the balloon floated down into this noble city, where I was instantly proclaimed the first wizard deluxe. Times being what they were, I accepted the job, retaining my balloon for a quick getaway. And of course, that's the Wizard of Oz talking to Dorothy after he had been discovered. If anyone had sneered at doom, it was the Germans, actually, after World War I. The bold wizardry by which they pulled themselves out of bankruptcy to challenge the world in a Second World War rivaled the audacity of the Kansas balloonist who mesmerized Oz. The Treaty of Versailles had imposed crushing reparation payments on Germany. The German people were expected to reimburse the costs of the war for all participants cost totaling 3 times the value of all the property in their country. Speculation in the German mark had caused it to plummet, precipitating one of the worst runaway inflations in modern times. At its peak, a wheelbarrow full of 100 billion mark banknotes could not buy a loaf of bread. The national treasury was completely broke, and huge numbers of homes and farms had been lost to the banks and speculators. People were living in hovels and starving. Nothing like it had ever happened before. The total destruction of the national currency, wiping out people's savings, their businesses, and the economy generally. So what to do? The German government followed the lead of the American greenbackers and issued its own fiat money. Hjalmar Schacht, then head of the German Central Bank, is quoted in a bit of wit that sums up the German version of the greenback miracle. An American banker had commented, "Dr. Schacht, you should come to America. We've lots of money, and that's real banking." Schacht replied, "You should come to Berlin. We don't have money. That's real banking." The German people were in such desperate straits that they relinquished control of the country to a dictator, and in this they obviously deviated from the American system, which presupposed a democratically governed commonwealth. But autocratic authority did give Adolf Hitler something the American greenbackers could only dream about: total control of the economy. He was able to test their theories, and he proved that they worked. Like for Lincoln, Hitler's choices were to either submit to total debt slavery or create his own fiat money. And like Lincoln, he chose the fiat solution. He implemented a plan of public works along the lines proposed by Jacob Coxey and the greenbackers in the 1890s. Projects earmarked for funding included flood control, repair of public buildings and private residences, and construction of new buildings, roads, bridges, canals, and port facilities. The projected cost of the various programs was fixed at 1 billion units of national currency. 1 billion non-inflationary bills of exchange, called labor treasury certificates, were then issued against this cost. Millions of people were put to work on these projects, and the workers were paid with treasury certificates. The workers then spent the certificates on goods and services, creating more jobs for more people. The certificates were also referred to as MEFO bills, or sometimes as Fedder money. They were not actually debt-free. They were issued as bonds, and the government paid interest on them, but they circulated as money and were renewable indefinitely, and they avoided the need to borrow from international lenders or to pay off international debts. Within 2 years, the unemployment problem had largely been solved. The country had a stable currency and was back on its feet at a time when millions of people in the United States and other Western countries were still out of work and living on welfare. Germany even managed to restore foreign trade, although it was denied foreign credit and was faced with an economic boycott abroad. It did this by using a barter system. Equipment and commodities were exchanged directly with other countries, circumventing the international banks. This system of direct exchange occurred without debt and without trade deficits. Germany's economic experiment, like Lincoln's, was short-lived, however. But it left some lasting monuments to its success, including the famous Autobahn, the world's first extensive superhighway. And we'll come back in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, according to Stephen Zerlenga in The Lost Science of Money, Hitler was exposed to the fiat money solution when he was assigned by German Army Intelligence to watch the German Workers' Party after World War I. He attended a meeting that made a deep impression on him, at which the views of Gottfried Fedder were propounded. Quote, The basis of Federer's ideas was that the state should create and control its money supply through a nationalized central bank rather than have it created by privately owned banks to whom interest would have to be paid. From this view derived the conclusion that finance had enslaved the population by usurping the nation's control of money. End quote. Zarlenga traces the idea that the state should create its own money to German theorists who had apparently studied the earlier American greenback movement. Where Federer and Hitler diverged from the American greenbackers was in equating the financiers who had enslaved the population with the ethnic race of the prominent bankers of the day. The result was to encourage a wave of anti-Semitism that darkened Germany and blackened its leader's name. The 19th century greenbackers saw more clearly what the true enemy was, not an ethnic group, but a financial scheme, one that transferred the power to create money from the collective body of the people to a private banking elite. The terrible human rights violations Germany fell into could have been avoided by a stricter adherence to the American system, keeping the reins of power with the people themselves. While Hitler clearly deserved the opprobrium heaped on him for his later military and racial aggressions, he was enormously popular with the German people, at least for a time. Zarlenga suggests that this was because he temporarily rescued Germany from English economic theory, the theory that money must be borrowed against the gold reserves of a private banking cartel rather than issued outright by the government. Again, the reasons for war are complex, but Zarlenga postulates that one is not found in the history books. Quote, perhaps Germany was expected to borrow gold internationally, and that would have meant external control over her domestic policies. Her decision to use alternatives to gold would mean that the international financiers would be unable to exercise this control through the international gold market, and this may have led to controlling Germany through warfare instead. End quote. Dr. Henry Macau, a Canadian researcher, adds some evidence for this theory. He quotes that from the 1938 interrogation of C.G. Rakovsky, one of the founders of Soviet Bolshevism and a Trotsky intimate, who was tried in show trials in the USSR under Stalin. Rakovsky maintained that Hitler had actually been funded by the international bankers through their agent Zalmer Schacht. The goal was to control Stalin, who had usurped power from Trotsky. But Hitler had become an even bigger threat than Stalin when he took the bold step of creating his own money. Rakovsky said, quote, Hitler took over for himself the privilege of manufacturing money, and not only physical monies, but also financial ones. He took over the untouched machinery of falsification and put it to work for the benefit of the state. Are you capable of imagining what would have come if it had infected a number of other states and brought about the creation of a period of autarky? If you can, then imagine its counter-revolutionary functions. End quote. Autarky is a national economic policy that aims at achieving self-sufficiency and eliminating the need for imports. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill reportedly wrote to Lord Robert Boothby, quote, Germany's unforgivable crime before the Second World War was her attempt to extricate her economic power from the world's trading system and to create her own exchange mechanism which would deny world finance its opportunity to profit. End quote. In his Military History of the Western World, British historian J.F.C. Fuller wrote, quote, Hitler held that as long as the international monetary system was based on gold, a nation which cornered gold could impose its will on those who lacked it. This could be done by drying up their sources of exchange and thereby compelling them to accept loans on interest. He decided, one, to refuse foreign interest-bearing loans and base German currency on production instead of on gold. Two, to obtain imports by barter. Three, to put a stop to what was called freedom of the exchanges, that is, license to gamble in currencies and shift private fortunes from one country to another according to the political situation. And four, to create money when men and material were available for work instead of running into debt by borrowing it. Because the life of international finance depended upon the issue of interest-bearing loans to nations in economic distress, Hitler's economics spelt his ruination. In 1936, Winston Churchill is reported to have said to General Robert E. Wood of America, "Germany is getting too strong and we must smash her." End quote. By 1938, Germany's resources were being diverted to war and totalitarian control. The strength of its economy, however, was a pre-war phenomenon. Economist Henry C.K. Liu observes, quote, "The Nazis came to power in Germany in 1933 at a time when the economy was in total collapse, with ruinous war reparation obligations and zero prospects for foreign investment or credit. Yet through an independent monetary policy of sovereign credit and a full employment public works program, the Third Reich was able to turn a bankrupt Germany, stripped of overseas colonies it could exploit, into the strongest economy in Europe within 4 years, even before armament spending began." End quote. In Billions for Bankers, Debts for the People, Sheldon Emery also credited Germany's phoenix-like rise from the ashes to its decision to issue its own money. He wrote, quote, "Germany financed its entire government and war operation from 1935 to 1945 without gold and without debts, and it took the whole capitalist and communist world to destroy the German power over Europe and bring Europe back under the heel of the bankers. Such history of money does not even appear in the textbooks of public government schools today." End quote. What does appear in modern textbooks is the disastrous runaway inflation suffered in 1923 by the Weimar Republic, the common name for the republic that governed Germany from 1919 to 1933. The radical devaluation of the German mark is cited as the textbook example of what could go wrong when governments are given the unfettered power to print money. That is what it is cited for. But again, in the complex world of economics, things are not always as they seem. So let's take another look at the Weimar hyperinflation. The Weimar financial crisis began with the crushing reparations payments imposed at the Treaty of Versailles. Hjalmar Schacht, who was then currency commissioner for the Republic, complained, quote, "The Treaty of Versailles is a model of ingenious measures for the economic destruction of Germany. The Reich could not find any way of holding its head above the water other than by the inflationary expedient of printing banknotes." End quote. Michael Hudson is an economist who has studied hyperinflation extensively. He asserts that every hyperinflation in history stems from the foreign exchange markets. It stems from governments trying to throw enough of their currency on the market to pay their foreign debts. And we will continue this in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.